That's a great question.
Here I am as Miss Kentucky, competed in Miss America, and it's been really an amazing journey.
So in Lexington in particular, we mostly resettle Congolese, and we have the largest population of Congolese within Kentucky.
And he said to me, science is cool, learning is fun. That's what we do.
All the schools in Kentucky present a power word presentation, which talks about verbal bullying, negative perceptions in hip-hop, how to challenge our peers when they use negative words. At the end of the day, words do matter, and it's a catalyst for action.
That's a great question. That's a powerful question. That's a question that I hope that all of us will continue to ponder on.
We'll be getting back out to playing live, but some places that I do like playing here in Lexington.
I tend to focus on local issues, local people, you know, local being Kentucky.
So we've got these various battles raging between the Attorney General and the governor, and in the background is the former governor.
This is a myth that is really common.
Mountain Dew is not a contraceptive.
Probably is going to cause a pretty bad yeast infection.
An extreme yeast infection.
If you can't deep fry it, spray paint it gold.
Now, will the animal send you like a postcard as a thank you with a little paw print on it?
Who's at fault more, men or women?
The vetting process. You already asked that? Okay.
It works. Grand piano.
Downtown somewhere, somewhere. Downtown.
If it's Friday and this show opener gag is getting tired, then it's Bluegrass Bios on WLXU LPFM Lexington Community Radio.
Never get tired.
I'm Kyle. He's Ben.
Yep. Hi.
And our third host, Chuck C. of the 1 o'clock hour, makes up the reoccurring speaking roles on our program. I'm compelled to tell you that we can be tweeted at Bluegrass Bios, even though that is fruitless information.
Like us on Facebook, anyway.
Yeah, please do.
Yeah.
It gives me the confidence that I need to go on.
And download us on iTunes.
Yeah, Ben, where else can we be found?
We can be found on iTunes. We can be found on LexingtonCommunityRadio.org or, you know, GoogleLCR.org. That should come up and go to Bluegrass Bios under the podcast menu. Listen to all of our shows there or subscribe on iTunes and get the last 30.
You know, it was our motto when I had initially started that you had given me to keep me calm. No one is listening, but that's not the case anymore.
That was actually never the case. I was just trying to keep you calm.
I still like to pretend that's the case sometimes.
Yeah, sure.
What are our numbers at as long as we're doing production on air?
Oh, in the dozens.
In the dozens.
Yes.
Squarely up to... Well, that's good. So I want to thank
more than just our parents.
Everyone's parents for telling their best friend and forcing them to listen as though it were Girl Scout cookie season. Our first guest today will be Dr. Wormling. He's a doctor of pharmacy, a professor at the University of Kentucky College of Pharmacy, and he is the founder and CEO of a company that has developed an anti-overdose nasal spray to counter the national heroin and prescription opioid pandemic in America. Yeah. It's cool. It's the drug existed. Let's see. I got the word.
It's been around for a while. I believe a few decades.
Naloxone is the drug. But what he has done is come up with a system of atomizing it so that it can be taken like your common over-the-counter nasal spray for allergies. So that for fast-acting
yes
relief from your heroin overdose.
I'm picturing the outline of the human head right now with the nasal spray going up and the soothing and the coating for your overdose.
You know what? I don't know if I'm going to bring this up with him, but it is ironic to me that nasal spray is known to be addicting.
Yeah, just regular over-the-counter nasal spray is not something you really want to do too much.
Yeah.
You want to get if you get a prescription, the prescription's okay, especially if it's antibiotic. But not you can do some serious damage with the over the counter nasal spray.
Yeah, that's maybe something you should take into consideration if you're a heroin addict. You know, just stay on the
heroin. Don't go to the nasal spray. I'm almost certain that's not how it works, but we'll ask the good doctor.
Certainly. He'll be in here in just about 10 minutes, I would say. Chuck C.
Yeah.
aforementioned host of the 1 o'clock hour with Ben Wolf. He will be using a Ouija board, presumably, to speak with P.T. Barnum and some circus elephants.
Yes, it's closing down.
Yeah, what are your feelings on the old circus close?
Well, the first thing, I remember going to see Ringling Brothers when I was, three or so at Rupp Arena. And it was the big show. It was hugely popular in late 70s, early 80s. It was probably the peak of its popularity. So sold out Rupp Arena, 20,000 people in there. They had the elephants, they had the lions, they had the clowns. I wasn't scared of clowns. And it was, it was a lot of fun. And you saw the trucks all out front of Rupp Arena in the Civic Center as you walked in, and you had your candy, and
I've never personally been to a circus of any kind, not a Ringling Brothers, not a De Soleil, but it feels like, another one of those institutions that's been ruined, right? Like, because it's not just, like, they're not closing down because they've just done all the circusing that one organization can do.
And also not because of animal cruelty. They fixed themselves up, I believe, in the late 80s after a lot of complaints.
There's still issues with that.
There are still issues.
Anytime you have animals in, not just in captivity, but performing, you're going to have PETA right up
and wearing ass. And wearing makeup, usually.
On the animals.
On the elephants.
So there was pressure there, and then obviously just, changing of tastes from the 19th century as far as entertainment.
People moving on.
It's kind of wistful. I suppose, I don't know that I would have ever been interested in going to a circus, but it's like this. You have a cartoon version of it in your head, right?
Certainly.
With the ringmaster, sort of a stout fellow with the let's just name things that are at the circus,
sometimes on stilts.
Right.
Wearing a top hat.
Lion tamers.
Lion tamers.
Bears on tricycles.
The trapeze artists. I believe the trapeze artists were the highlights of the evening, and just what they can do in midair without a net. They had the net to start.
Right.
And then I think they did this on purpose. They failed a leap or hand-to-hand or whatever it was, and somebody goes plummeting down to the net. And then 10 minutes later,
they take
the net away.
Right.
In retrospect, I'm just realizing that
That's
now.
Genius.
That was probably part of the show to create a little level of suspense.
That's got to be like a family business, right?
Oh, It's got to be, yeah. Well, I think the Willindas is what you're thinking of. The Flying Willindas?
Right.
They were the family of trapeze artists and daredevils and
line
wire walkers and stuff like that. So it kind of has become known. And even if they aren't family, they say they are. So.
Right. The backstory of Robin.
Yeah, that was what I was thinking.
Along
of.
Those lines,
yes,
too.
Yes.
The big top, it'll get folded up one final time. So however you feel about that, tweet us at Bluegrass Bios. All right. What else do I got? I want to, we have an inauguration.
The inauguration is going on as we speak, as this is airing.
Right.
So thank you for listening to us. Maybe you're listening to us and watching the inauguration at the same time.
Yes.
In which case you've won.
If you're trying to do like a simulcast, and I can narrate your visual, he has bad hair. I think that's what we're seeing right now. His hair is actually blowing away up into the sky. My God, it's been fake all along.
Oh, how about that? I did not see that.
The clown retired.
I would imagine half the people there are booing and half the people there are applauding. And he's talking about something being huge and bigly.
Yeah, I don't. I'm not watching this, obviously, because I'm sitting here telling you all. But it's. I mean, there's supposed to be protesters.
I imagine.
By the many.
Yeah, yeah. And I wonder who they'll get to perform. That's kind of up in the air as of this moment. I know they've got the Mormon Tabernacle Choir and a college marching band. Mm. But apart from that, I'm not sure. Maybe Wayne Newton?
Yeah.
I don't know if Scott Baio knows how to sing.
I haven't.
That I could watch.
Scott Baio sing.
Yeah.
What did you make of the news story, the fake news story that came from BuzzFeed. You obviously, you know.
Yeah. To, right?
If you don't know.
The aristocrats joke. That
exactly, became, yeah. And you fill in any blanks here for our audience that I'm not familiar with, but essentially a BuzzFeed article that had unsubstantiated allegations that Donald Trump was being extorted or
extorted,
controlled by the Russian government because they had video of him being urinated on by Russian prostitutes, R. Kelly style.
Oh, see, I heard it was the other way around.
Oh, that he was doing
that.
He was showering.
But who knows?
That was weird. Debunked as fake, right? Like, I don't know that.
I can't prove that Donald Trump isn't a Martian either, but I think odds are against it.
Well, it's the BuzzFeed article that had no factual information whatsoever that ended up getting run with by the New York Times. Like, it's it's insanity.
The
state of journalism is coming to.
The state of journalism is bad, and speaking personally, I think is probably the least offensive thing Donald Trump has done in the last year and a half.
Yeah, I think that's probably.
I have for the much inauguration. Bigger. I have capitalism. It's a transaction. I don't care. The things he said while campaigning bother me much more.
Yes,
they're politicians. Well, I mean, politicians
just
are weird.
Focusing it on his relationship with the media, he was able to take the high ground on this because this BS story was getting portrayed to him by legitimate journalists, and he's standing up there going. Telling CNN your news is fake, you are fake news, and it puts
would know. His former campaign manager was on CNN for several months.
His former campaign manager?
Yeah, CNN hired him and made him a talking head.
Oh yeah, I remember that guy.
Yeah, yeah. Before Kellyanne,
right? It's just who knows what's going to happen at this inauguration. I just listened to a gentleman speak very passionately for about 10 minutes that the majority of the crowd there, of the rabble-rousers at least, are bought and paid for by Max, by question mark. I'm not quite sure. There's just a lot of misinformation going around when it comes to the media, and
we need better BS detectors. Personally, we got to get a little more savvy when it comes to this stuff, and always be very careful of reading something that tells you exactly what you want to hear.
Right, that's good.
That's your advice, detection should go off.
The if we're talking about newspapers of record, like
even newspapers. Then when you see a newspaper article that quotes, who do you trust
if you're not trust? Because all you're saying now is don't trust information.
I'm saying be skeptical of information. But, you know, if you go to the Associated Press and you read an article that's in the weeds and it's boring, that's usually true. The more boring something is, the more truth it usually has to it. And you've got Reuters, and you've got McClatchy, and you have some good, very good print and wire services out there.
The point is that we've had a hierarchy on veracity for 100 years, and now the top of the food chain is lying in the muck with the prawns. You know, it's somewhat disturbing because if you don't have these trustworthy watchdog groups to tell you what's happening behind the curtain, then democracy ultimately suffers, right?
And, absolutely, yes.
You know, I don't know. I would prefer to not be a skeptic. I did not vote for President-elect Donald J. Trump.
You didn't?
Believe it or not.
Oh.
There's... His true colors, besides orange, are yet to reveal themselves. In my opinion,
maybe we can get some fun out of this.
So
maybe it'll just be fun for a little while.
Yeah. Hey, stand-up comedy will be.
Oh yeah, that's gonna
will surge. Will soar during these next 4 years. All right, I think the good Dr. Wormling is here. So speaking of good information, we're gonna bring him in just a second. He's a professor, a doctor of pharmacy at UK, and his invention is meant to treat heroin and other opiate overdoses. So we're going to bring him in just a second. You're listening to Lexington Community Radio. We are Bluegrass Bios.
Tune in to Urban Conversations
every Monday and Wednesday from 4 to 6 p.m. on 93.9 WLXU.
Come sit in the lounge with us. I'm your host, Jammin.
And I'm your host, Future, where your voice matters.
Any questions?
Welcome back to Bluegrass Bios on Lexington Community Radio. I'm Kyle. I'm with Ben.
Hey, Kyle.
And our first guest of the show is on the line with us right now. He's Dr. Daniel Wormling, professor at UK's College of Pharmacy, founder and CEO of Anti-Ope, Inc. Anti-Ope or Anti-Op?
Anti-op.
Anti-op. Thank you. That's important to know. He developed an intranasal spray to treat opioid overdose. How are you doing today, Dan?
Thank you. I'm well.
So jumping right in, how did you come involved in the pursuing of an anti-opioid treatment?
Well, I started in 2009 by two motivations. One was a paper that a professor friend of mine handed me from the public health literature entitled Save by the Nose, Administering Naloxone to Prevent Overdoses. And 1 month after receiving that paper is when the marker I have for it is the week that Michael Jackson passed away.
Oh, wow.
But the event that was local was an MSNBC.com article on the internet that described two Morehead State University students who passed away after being in a 30-day voluntary rehabilitation program in Mount Sterling. And after going through that program, unfortunately, they went back to using. And the thing that they didn't understand is that they can't use the doses that they had in the past. They had their brain had lost tolerance to these medicines. And so when you go back to use the dose that you had before, it will be a significant overdose, and they passed away. That was sort of my period where I had said I'd had enough. I had been watching data from the Centers for Disease Control for a couple years, 2007-08. And the data for Kentucky were quite troubling in that we were typically first, second, third, or fourth in the nation for per capita opioid overdose. So even though we're a state of, back then, roughly 4.2 million people, we had the highest overdose rates in the country, in particular for rural parts of the state, where, you know, if 40 or 50 people passed away in a county of 30 or 40,000 people, that almost everybody would know someone that died. And obviously then this relates back to the huge tragedy that involves for the communities themselves. There's a personal tragedy, there's a societal tragedy, socioeconomic tragedy, vitality of the community itself is sapped. Those were all things that struck me at that time. The data continued to get worse, but at that point, I decided to come forward because my research for other topics had been with intranasal drug delivery for other things like seizure treatment and pain for emergency use where you don't have needles involved, and naloxone, the antidote to opioids, fit the chemistry for nasal drug delivery and ambulance services, paramedics, and larger cities had shown that paramedics could use the injectable product that was on the market and adapt it for nasal delivery and spray it in overdose victims' noses, and that they could wake them up without having to put an intravenous line in them. And so as I was reading the literature and understanding the dimensions of this problem, I thought that I had some of the skills to develop a medicine for an alternative delivery that was designed for this purpose, from that point, I filed for grants from the National Institute for Drug Abuse and matching grants that occur from the Kentucky Science and Technology Corporation, representing the Commonwealth of Kentucky, and was successful with those grant submissions and also with submissions to the Food and Drug Administration to begin the drug development process. And so I did all of those things for submissions in 2009 and 10 and was fortunate to receive the funding and to begin the process of development. From there, 2009 and 10 was really the origins of all this work.
Just so we're defining our terms, Dr. Daniel Wermeling, professor at UK College of Pharmacy, on with us. When we're talking about opioids, for those that aren't that are the uninitiated, we're not talking just about the sexy black tar heroin, right? When we're talking about opioids, what is that chemically?
So opioids are a class of chemicals that have either an original derivation from opium poppies. So natural products like heroin and morphine and others come from the sap of an opium poppy. And then chemists can alter the chemistry to make what we call semi-synthetic opioids, which are in the common prescription products such as Vicodin and Percocet, where hydrocodone and oxycodone are semi-synthetic derivatives of morphine. The chemical changes make them very appropriate for the oral treatment of acute and chronic pain, and their chemistry has been adapted to make them appropriate for making pills.
But the addictive properties are essentially the same.
The same, yeah. So in terms of the pharmacologic properties in the brain, they're the same. Or they may be, to a scientist, they may have slight differences, but, you know, the larger picture is that pharmacologically, they produce a similar effect. The differences are really just a matter of the potency and how many milligrams of X, Y, or Z opioid it takes to get the same effect.
Can you explain what happens in the body? You're talking about tolerances earlier with those Moorhead students, how they'd gone through rehabilitation and then attempted to take a similar dosage before they'd gone to rehab, had a massive overdose. What is happening in the body during a heroin or opioid overdose?
So many medications we have interact with what we call receptors in our body, meaning that there's, on the surface of a cell, there's a location where this medication fits. And God or whomever helped create us has designed our bodies to receive certain chemicals. Some of them are endogenous, meaning our bodies make them. And we have our own endogenous system of opioids that were meant to treat pain. Our brains and our bodies make them. And so our receptors are there to receive them. But morphine and opium and others then are exogenous sources that also interact with these receptors. And so we have these receptors in our brain. And for the pharmacologic properties that we find useful, opioids interacting with these receptors provide analgesia, pain relief, and other things that we find useful. So like codeine cough syrup, for example, it suppresses cough and performs other things throughout the body that doctors can prescribe that are considered useful. The problem that comes in then is when we receive too much of a medicine, and this could be a lot of different medicines, not just opioids. But in this case, with opioids, the next things that occur when doses are getting too high is that people become sleepy, sedated, and if it goes further, they can become unconscious and unresponsive.
So essentially, when they are in the body to such a degree that what your systems are shutting down?
I
see.
Yeah, so the brain in itself is being shut down. Just thinking about alcohol as an example, people can drink certain amounts and they'll feel fine with it, but if they keep drinking alcohol, they become sleepy.
Sure.
And if they keep drinking, they'll pass out. And in this case, it's similar that you can continue to take opioids to a point where you would become unconscious and further that you would be unresponsive to people calling your name, yelling at you, or rub your chest or on your head to induce a little pain to stimulate you, and you won't respond. Now, that's not what kills you, though, unconsciousness. What kills people is that there's an area in the brain that tells us to breathe automatically. We don't think about it, right?
So this messes with the autonomic processes?
The autonomic processes then that are operating from the behind part of your skull that cause you to breathe automatically. You don't think about it. It's unconscious. But then these centers are affected, and your breathing rate and depth of breathing, how hard you breathe, continue to diminish to a point that some people may stop breathing completely. So injecting medicines can do this very quickly. Pills can do it, but it takes longer.
Well, that was my next question, is what is it about the nasal spray and spraying something into the nose that makes this so effective?
So naloxone, let me explain naloxone first.
Please.
So naloxone is the antidote, meaning it competes at the receptor in the brain for occupancy of the receptor. And so if we can get enough of the receptors occupied by naloxone, then the effects of the opioid can be diminished to a point where people will wake up and they will start breathing. Most importantly, they will start breathing again on their own.
Is it a stimulant, or does it just take the place of the depressant?
It just takes the place of the depressant. It has no other action. And so naloxone has no other independent pharmacologic action. If you gave naloxone to a healthy, awake person, they likely won't notice anything.
Interesting.
Nothing will happen. It generally would only work on someone who has opioids in their system.
And how long do you have to administer naloxone after an overdose?
As a general matter, it's unknown. If someone stops breathing, we know that within minutes,
Right, okay.
Starting to be damaged.
Right.
Think of drowning, because the consequence is the same, is that the person's not getting oxygen because they have fluid in their lungs. In this case, they don't have oxygen because they're not being able to breathe on their own. So things start to happen that are adverse to the health of your brain as minutes are passing.
Understood. Yes, the breathing part, that's important to the living.
That's what's critical.
Yeah. So prior to your invention, the administration of naloxone was done primarily by injection, correct?
Yes, and so most of the use of naloxone was in hospitals, in the post-operative recovery rooms, and in the emergency rooms, where opioids were given therapeutically, and sometimes people received more than was necessary, and we needed to wake them up a little bit more to preserve their health.
So in terms of effectiveness, is the brilliance of the innovation that it is effective at removing or replacing opioids at the receptor level, or is it that it is now more easily transportable and available to consumers?
It's the latter. Ambulances and paramedics, you know, they give injectable naloxone all the time, every day. And the nasal administration for paramedics was adopted because 80% of the people they treated in large cities were either hepatitis C, B, or HIV positive. So waking people up from an overdose can lead to agitation and combativeness by those who are being awakened.
I see.
And having needles in that environment is an occupational hazard for paramedics, where they could get an accidental needle stick and acquire an infectious disease.
Yes, I understand.
So that was the paramedic motivation. But the other is that medically, we wouldn't want to have more needles being distributed necessarily for any kind of potential accident. And so we use nasal delivery as a way of administering a medicine quickly in a needle-free way. And so it's the same as giving an intramuscular injection, not IV, but the treatment effect is very similar to giving an intramuscular injection.
which is part of the injectable product labeling that doctors and paramedics use if they don't have IV intravenous access. So nasal provides the same outcome or very similar outcome as administering a muscle shot. Now, the trick, though, is to creating a formulation that's appropriate for the nasal administration. So that's one of the innovations, and to get it into a device that people can use effectively.
And it's a common one, right? It's something that people take for their allergies every day.
That's right. And so people understand using nasal sprays like Afrin nasal spray for colds, nasal steroids that are used for allergies you see on television. And so they understand nasal delivery. And so it's relatively convenient. It's not complicated. You don't need needles. There's not an infectious disease hazard. And it appears to be as effective as other routes.
You were explaining, you began research and development in 2009 with the aid of some funding. What was your experience with testing out your invention?
So we created approximately 24 prototypes. So when you read the label of a drug and you see the active and inactive ingredients, it's the inactive ingredients and how you process this product that makes it suitable for meeting patient needs and FDA standards. And so we had 24 prototypes with all kinds of different excipient combinations and processing that helped us narrow down from 24 to 12 to 4 to 2 to 1 the number of formulation candidates that satisfy FDA standards and that would still be appropriate to put in someone's nose without causing damage. So there's a safety element. So there's effectiveness and safety. And so the active is what we would use, and then we have inactive ingredients that are appropriate and tolerable by the nasal mucosa that won't cause damage. So then the next step is to actually test that in healthy volunteers, which we did the first study here at the University of Kentucky under three doctors, Dr. Val Adams, Sandy Archer, and Catherine Martin. And so those three doctors then conducted the human study of comparing the nasal spray to standard injectable methods. And we were able to then determine that this looked like we were going to approximate the effectiveness of injections.
And how do you approximate something like that? Because you can't give people overdoses, and you certainly can't do it out in the field playing with somebody's life.
Question. So the way that this is done, the way the FDA had proposed it, which we agree with, is that we can't do studies with placebo-controlled trials as we do in other areas because it's unethical and overdose.
Right.
So what we do is measure the blood levels of the drug achieved across all the routes of administration. And so if our nasal administration blood levels parallel those by an intramuscular injection, then you would assume that they will be equally effective because blood levels correlate to what happens in the brain.
You can do this by administering it to otherwise healthy and non-addicted persons? Oh, wow.
Right, because it's just the injectable that's the cognate, right? So if you can take that and know the effectiveness of this already used naloxone injection, then you just compare that to the spray against very low levels of opioid reception. Is that correct, Doctor?
Yeah, so there's no opioids involved. It's just a matter of, can we be equivalent to the blood levels achieved by those that are already approved by the FDA? And so we demonstrated that. And then the subjects were examined by an ear, nose, and throat physician, Dr. Sanford Archer at UK, and demonstrated that there were no pathologic changes to the nose or the nasal mucosa as a result of administering this drug into the healthy volunteers. And so those were the data that we brought to the Food and Drug Administration and said, okay, now this is our pilot work, if you will,
And then we need to go back to conducting a formal, statistically controlled trial. And those things were done also. And so those are the two pharmacokinetic, what we call pharmacokinetic studies, the study of the metabolism of the drug in the bloodstream in the body, where we were able to demonstrate that the blood levels of this product were approximate to, equivalent to, those that are achieved by already approved routes and doses. And if you can prove that, then the FDA is interested in then approving your product.
Well, I've read that you that your product was fast-tracked through the FDA. What is that process like, and how? I don't imagine that they grant that very often.
No, it has to be something for a life-threatening illness in which we do not have adequate treatment at the moment. Those are the rules.
So what was the duration of FDA scrutiny?
Oh, short. It was, in this case, these issues were a priority for the FDA. And so granting fast-track status occurred within 60 to 90 days. It was not a burdensome process at all.
Oh, wow. And when did you first get to try this out in the field, and what was your reaction when it worked?
No, I don't see them in action myself, mm-hmm. but...
Sounds like a fun night, though.
Well, what happens, though, is that people are going to experience withdrawal. And so if you've seen withdrawal symptoms portrayed in television, they're pretty true to life. And you are reversing the effect of the opioids. And then for an hour or two, they're going to feel the effects of withdrawal, which are very uncomfortable. The best way I can think of explaining it is it's the worst flu you've ever had. Mm.
Well, and it's sped up, right? Because it's the instant.
It's kind of pretty quick. And so people can get, you know, their heart will be racing, their blood pressure goes up, they'll start sweating, they may get nauseated, they may vomit. And so those are all the visible signs of someone in withdrawal, and they'll feel sick. So when I talk to people on Fridays, I go to the Fayette County Health Department, to the needle exchange program, and I dispense naloxone to high-risk individuals there. I guess we started that in early September, and in mid to late October, we started getting clients or patients coming back requesting refills, meaning that the kit had been used. And about half of the time, someone saves the patient that we sent the kit home with, and the other times, half of it is when the person we prescribed and released the kit to used it on someone else. But typically, they describe that, you know, they're sick. And what they mean by that is that they have the symptoms of withdrawal, so they don't feel well.
Now, if somebody needs the nasal spray and they come to the needle exchange on Fridays, do they have to give you any personal information, any phone numbers,
yes,
address?
It's not phone numbers, but... So it's a prescription medicine, but it's free. So if they come to needle exchange, the needle exchange program, because of law, doesn't require any release of information. But for naloxone, it's still a prescription medicine, and we have to handle it as such. But I would say 95%+ of the people, because they understand it, many of them have received naloxone, they've seen overdoses, and they're very grateful to get access to it, that they're not worried about it because it's handled no differently than if you came to the Kentucky Clinic Pharmacy on Limestone Street, and you came to the clinic pharmacy and you had to turn over the same information to have a prescription filled. It's just that in my case, I bring the naloxone kits with me to the health department, along with prescription paperwork, and they fill out the paperwork, they receive the training, the counseling on how to use it, and then they leave with a free kit, which is over $100 a dose retail. Mm. And so they leave with no expense to have a kit. It's all federally protected as protected health information under HIPAA, the Health Information Portability Act. And so it's no different than if you showed up at the Kentucky Clinic Pharmacy, your personal health data is protected.
We're talking to Dr. Daniel Wormling. He's a professor at UK's College of Pharmacy. He's also the founder and CEO of Antiop, Inc. They have developed an intranasal spray to treat opioid overdose. Dr. Wormling, I wanted to get your thoughts maybe on a thought that I had had, and that's kind of the unintended consequences of having naloxone so readily available to addicts. Is that a potential for further abuse because it's like now you've got a plan B in your medicine cabinet?
Yeah, that's a common misunderstanding.
I misunderstand things very commonly.
So the common thought is that the individual with a substance use disorder will feel some comfort that they can use more drugs because they know they have the antidote there in case they get into trouble. And the research on this has shown that having access to naloxone has no effect whatsoever on how they think. So you and I are thinking logically because we're sober. You see what I'm saying?
You hadn't smelled Ben's coffee.
So, you know, that has a direct bearing then on one, you have to understand how that person thinks versus how you think.
Right.
And they're totally different. The other that I try to give as an analogy to explain this to people is that as garlic is to vampires, naloxone is to addicts. Neither one wants to experience that again. And so when you see the movies, you know, where we have these portrayals of Dracula, right? And so we have crosses and garlic, and vampires find that aversive. So do people who have had received naloxone. They know what it is. They know what it's about. They're thankful for their lives to be saved. But they also understand it makes them feel terrible.
Yeah, there's no get-out-of-jail-free card, is there?
There's no get-out-of-jail-free card. This is not enabling because they're trying to either people that are tired or starting to burn out on this, they use heroin to not get sick, but they're not necessarily trying to get high. And then you have other people who are. The risks are all the same, though, because injecting is a very high-risk activity. And now with fentanyl being mixed in with heroin, it's an even greater risk because that's a drug we use by injection in the hospital for anesthesiologists to use to provide anesthesia. It works very quickly and will make you unconscious before you can get the needle out of your arm.
Dr. Wormling, we appreciate you coming on with us today. I wanted to ask you one more question. And I guess it's, where do you see this public availability of naloxone as it pertains to the opioid pandemic, you know, even in just Kentucky in, let's say, 10 years?
So naloxone is a stopgap measure. It'll help save lives as an interim. But the person, the patient, their brain hasn't changed. Right, their brain chemistry hasn't changed in the sense that they need the opioid, and how they think hasn't changed. And so my hope is that people seek treatment. They have to get into treatment because eventually this will catch up. Every time you overdose, your risk of dying doubles, starting at 0.5% of death risk for your first time. And so if you double that every time by about 8 overdoses, you are darn lucky to be alive. The success of this has two paradigms. One is that we prevent, by education and other means, young people, children, high schoolers, from getting into this, because that's a new generation of people. They're unexposed. But now we have a whole generation or two generations of people as adults that are exposed to opioids. And so we have prevention for young people. And then we have to get treatment with medication-assisted treatment and counseling and other things that are necessary to rebuild their life, their social network, how they live, to get a job, to support themselves, to support their families. It's a very complicated thing to try and rebuild somebody's life to reenter society. And that's what so many of our counselors and shelters and places like the Hope Center and the Chrysalis House, and I can't can't even name them. There's so many who are trying to do this. But it takes all of these factors all at once. You can't just work on one and then expect a successful outcome. You have to address all of these factors of humanity, of what it means to be a human, to bring someone back into society. After watching social workers and others who toil very difficultly at this, but that's what it takes.
Thanks to your efforts, they'll hopefully be alive to make those choices. Dr. Wermling, thank you very much for coming on with us, sir.
Well, you're welcome, and please refer more people to the health department so that we can get clean needles and naloxone and other services to those in need.
Dr. Wermling, professor at UK's College of Pharmacy, founder and CEO of Antiop, Inc., developed an intranasal spray to treat opioid overdose and a mensch. Thank you very much for coming on with us, sir.
You've been very kind.
All right. We're running a little bit over on Bluegrass Bios, so for the first hour, we're going to call that a wrap, and second hour, we'll have Chuck C. not actually speaking to P.T. Barnum from the grave.
Aww.
He will be interviewing the vice mayor, Mr. Steve Kay, so please stay tuned for that. For me, I'm signing off. Have a great weekend, Lexington.